Warbreaker by Brandon Sanderson. Vasher used the prison keys to unlock the cell door, then stepped inside. This man's aura made colors grow brighter by sharp measure when they got close to him. Anyone would be able to notice an aura that strong, though it was much easier for someone who had reached the first heightening. It wasn't the strongest biochromatic aura Vasher had ever seen. Those belonged to the Returned, known as gods here in Helendren. Still, this prisoner's biochroma was very impressive and much, much stronger than Vasher's own. This prisoner held a lot of breaths, hundreds upon hundreds of them. The man swung in his bonds, studying Vasher, gagged lips bleeding from lack of water. Vasher hesitated only briefly, then reached up and pulled the gag free.
"You," the prisoner whispered, coughing slightly. "Are you here to free me?"
"No, Var," Vasher said quietly. "I'm here to kill you."
Var snorted. Captivity hadn't been easy on him. When Vasher had last seen Var, he'd been plump. Judging by his emaciated body, he'd been without food for some time now. The cuts, bruises, and burn marks on his flesh were fresh. Both the torture and the haunted look in Var's bagged-rimmed eyes spoke a solemn truth. Breath could only be transferred by willing, intentional command. That command could, however, be encouraged.
"So," Var croaked, "you judge me, just like everyone else."
"Your failed rebellion is not my concern. I just want your breath."
"You and the entire Helendren court."
"Yes, but you're not going to give it to one of the Returned. You're going to give it to me, in exchange for killing you."
"Doesn't seem like much of a trade."
There was a hardness, a void of emotion in Var that Vasher had not seen the last time they'd parted, years before. Odd, Vasher thought, that I should finally, after all this time, find something in the man I can identify with. Vasher kept a wary distance from Var. Now that the man's voice was free, he could command. However, he was touching nothing except for the metal chains, and metal was very difficult to awaken. It had never been alive, and it was far from the form of a man. Even during the height of his power, Vasher himself had only managed to awaken metal on a few select occasions. Of course, some extremely powerful awakeners could bring objects to life that they weren't touching, but which were in the sound of their voice. That, however, required the ninth heightening. Even Var didn't have that much breath. In fact, Vasher knew of only one living person who did. The God King himself.
"Well," Var asked. "Give me the breath, Var," Vasher said, stepping forward.
Var snorted.
"I doubt you have the skill of the God King's torturers, Vasher. I've withstood them for 2 weeks now."
"You'd be surprised, but that doesn't matter. You are going to give me your breath. You know you only have two choices. Give it to me, or give it to them."
Var hung by his wrists, rotating slowly. Silent.
"You don't have much time to consider," Vasher said. "Any moment now, someone is going to discover the dead guards outside. The alarm will be raised. I'll leave you, and you will be tortured again. And eventually, you will break. Then all the power you've gathered will go to the very people you vowed to destroy."
The Dead House by Billy O'Callaghan.
"Tonight, I have a story to tell. One that for years I've kept buried. One that I hoped could have remained so forever. But the circumstances of the past several hours have brought everything once again to the surface, and I can no longer deny the things I've seen. This is the truth, as I know it to be. This is what I remember. At the very least, I want this to stand as a kind of confession. No, not only want, need. Even now, I find myself clinging to the idea that some
vital and previously overlooked detail will reveal itself, some glint sparkling away in the dark distance with a final offer of salvation, something I have long misread or overlooked. God. Hope. Something. Clinging to logic in the face of every contradiction, because time, as we all know, can blur things. But maybe it can also, in its way, bring clarity. I only hope that, with so much at stake, I have not waited too long to speak of this. And if it should prove that I am deluding myself, that talking changes nothing, then tell me, please, if you can, what choice do I have? Hoping for the best, even in the face of certain worst, is how we all live our lives. Isn't that the reason why so many of us pray? I suppose, in the final analysis, this story will hang on a single burning question. Do you believe in ghosts? Because that's where it really begins, with belief. We glimpse or experience something that defies explanation, and we either accept the stretch in our reality, or we choose to turn our heads away. It's a question that torments even philosophers. Do you believe? Our minds build our worlds for us, setting a line between what is acceptable as truth and what is not. We are conditioned to doubt the reality of the supernatural and encouraged to assume that our world holds nothing more than the details of its surface. There is little about life, as we have come to know it, that can't be explained away on some basic scientific level. Yet when the wind howls, and we find ourselves alone, with only the yellow pool of a guttering candle to hold back the darkness, our instinct, perhaps our innate need for something above and beyond, still screams otherwise. That is, as I say, where it begins, with belief. I've seen, and the truth is that even now, with all that has happened and all that seems to be happening again, a part of me remains uncertain. The stains of skepticism are just as hard to scrub away as those of faith. What I do know is that, for me at least, the past simply will not remain the past. The dead refuse to rest, or even to lie still. And I am not asking you to believe. I ask only that you give yourself time and space to consider the question, and that you listen with an open mind. Because this is something that I need to tell.
Surface Detail by Ian M. Banks. He jogged down the stairs to the basement. The stairwell was poorly lit, and he'd forgotten how far down the level holding the deepest strongrooms was. He'd rung up for a lift in the house, but even as he'd stood watching the floor indicator display winking on and off with an error code, he'd realized he shouldn't step into an elevator car in the circumstances, even if one did arrive. He stopped on the last landing, above a pool of darkness beneath, and dug inside the hide bag, pulling out a pair of night vision glasses, lighter, less bulky, but also less sophisticated versions of the oculenses Jaskin had worn. They weren't working either. He threw them away. Next thing he tried was a torch, but the flashlight refused to work too. He smashed it against the wall. That felt good. At least the bag was getting lighter. He felt his way down the last few stairs and opened the door to a better lit corridor beyond. Pipes and conduits covered the ceiling. The floor was concrete, and a few large metal doors were the only adornments to the rough cast walls. A few very dim lights were on constantly. Others were flickering. He was a little surprised Jaskin wasn't here already. He supposed time seemed to move oddly when everything was getting this fraught. He checked the antique watch. At least 12 minutes to go. The strongroom door was a massive, circular metal plug as tall as a man and a meter thick. The display, he'd forgotten it even had a display, was blinking an error message.
Shit!
He screamed, smashing one fist on the door. He rolled the code in anyways, but the noises the mechanism made didn't even sound right and the display didn't alter. Certainly, there was no series of reassuring clicks from umpteen places around the door's circumference, as there would have been if it was unlocking itself. He tried the levers and handles that then had to be moved, but they wouldn't budge. He glimpsed movement further down the long curve of the corridor, near a set of doors leading to another stairwell. "Jaskin!" he called. It was hard to tell in the dim, inconstant light. Maybe it was the culture lunatic who'd come here to apprehend him again. He pulled the Jalupian gun out. No, the figure moving towards him moved normally, looked Sechultian. "Jaskin?" he shouted. The figure stopped, maybe 30 meters away. It raised its arms level in front of it, gripping something. A gun! He realized that something flashed. He started to fall into a crouch. There was a smack and a whine from somewhere way overhead and to his left, then a barking roar came ringing down the corridor. Crouching on one knee, he aimed the Jalupian gun at the figure and pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. He tried again. The figure fired the gun once more, and a bullet kicked off the top of the strongroom door, whining away behind him as another thunderclap of noise pulsed down the corridor. He could see smoke swirling around the figure. Smoke? What were they firing? A fucking musket? But at least their gun still worked, unlike the Jalupian blaster. Like a knife would still work. "Fuck, fuck, fuck," he said, throwing the useless gun away and scrabbling to his feet, holding the hide bag between him and the figure down the corridor as he ran for the doors he'd just come through. The Inner Game of Tennis by Timothy Galway. But can one learn to play out of mind on purpose? How can you be consciously unconscious? It sounds like a contradiction in terms. Yet this state can be achieved. Perhaps a better way to describe the player who is unconscious is by saying that his mind is so concentrated, so focused, that it is still. It becomes one with what the body is doing, and the unconscious or automatic functions are working without interference from thoughts. The concentrated mind has no room for thinking how well the body is doing, much less of the how-tos of the doing. When the player is in this state of concentration, he is really into the game. He is at one with the racket, ball, and stroke. He discovers his true potential. The ability to approach this state is the goal of the inner game. The development of inner skills is required, but it is interesting to note that if, while learning tennis, you begin to learn control of the mind to concentrate the energy of awareness, you have learned something far more valuable than how to hit a forceful backhand. The backhand can be used to advantage only on the tennis court, but the skill of mastering the art of effortless concentration is invaluable in whatever you set your mind to. A major breakthrough in my attempts to understand the art of control of mind and body came when, while teaching, I again began to notice what was taking place before my eyes. Listen to the way players talk to themselves on the court. "Come on, Tom, meet the ball in front of you." We're interested in what is happening inside the player's mind. Who is telling who what? Most players are talking to themselves on the court all the time. "Get up for the ball. Keep it to his backhand. Keep your eyes on the ball. Bend your knees." The commands are endless. For some, it's like hearing a tape recording of the last lesson playing inside their head. Then, after the shot is made, another thought flashes through the mind that might be expressed as follows. "You clumsy ox, your grandmother could play better." One day, I was wondering who was talking to whom. Who was scolding, and who was being scolded? "I'm talking to myself," say most people. But just who is this I? And who is the myself? Obviously, the I and the myself are separate entities, or there would be no conversation. So one could say that within each player, there are two selves.
One, the I, seems to give instructions. The other, myself, seems to perform the action. Then I returns with an evaluation of the action.